Best-selling sports writer and sports commentator John Feinstein is back with Rush for Gold, Mystery at the Olympics, a sports thriller that features teen journalist Stevie Thomas and Susan Carol Anderson returning to investigate another mystery in the sports world, this time at the Summer Olympics in London. In this book, Susan Carol isn't a reporter. She's an Olympian competing as a swimmer at her first Olympic Games. Stevie is both proud and envious of her athletic prowess, but he's also worried about the agents, sponsors, and media that want to get up close and personal with Susan Carol. How far will they go to ensure that America's newest Olympic darling takes home the gold? Again, the name of the book is Rush for the Gold, Mystery at the Olympics. And John Feinstein, it's a great pleasure to have you back on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, thank you. It's good to talk to you again.
You know, you've been on for, many subjects, but on these thrillers that you have written for kids featuring these teens. And it's fascinating. You've brought them into a myriad of sporting venues. So it seems it was inevitable. Eventually you'd wind up at the Olympics.
I think you're right about that. I've covered the Olympics multiple times myself. I think at its best, the Olympics are about as exciting and emotional as sporting events can be. The greatest moment in my life as a sports fan was probably the U.S. victory over the Soviet Union in 1980 in Lake Placid in the hockey game. So I have many fond memories of that. And right from the start of this series that you mentioned, I've set Susan Carol up as a swimmer. And I did that for two reasons. One was because I'm an old swimmer. And so I wanted one of the characters to be a little bit like me in that sense, and I decided to make it the girl, not the boy, because I didn't want to follow the old jock stereotypes. But also because in the back of my mind, at some point I thought I wanted to take the kids to the Olympics. And this seemed an ideal way to do it. And by making her into a competitor, rather than, as you said, working as a journalist alongside Stevie, I think that changes the nature of the plot. It also changes the nature of their relationship. And as I said, because I did swim, even though I swim much more slowly than the Olympians, I can certainly relate to the pain that they feel at the end of races.
One of the things I found interesting, I mentioned in the introduction, but I found interesting about the book, because it really is a sort of a recurring theme in your book in talking about sports in general, about this concern about agents and sponsors and the media, and how that dilutes, or if you even want to go stronger, pollutes the athleticism.
Yeah, it's always a concern, Joe. And the number of athletes I've seen who, when you first meet them, they're totally into their sport, and there's an innocence to them, and they're very open. And then you see that change. The prime example of all the athletes I've met across the years would be Michael Jordan, who I first met when he was a freshman in college at North Carolina. He was outgoing. He had a sense of humor. He didn't have any sense of being more important than everybody else about him. And then when you encountered him 10 years later, after he'd been tremendously influenced by his agent, David Falk, and by people at Nike and others, he was a different person. He was defensive. He gave very one-note answers, sounded like he was speaking, you know, he was going by rote. Just a 180-degree change. And you see this to one degree or another with many athletes. And part of this book is about Susan Carol facing these questions about how much do you allow yourself to change because of fame and because of potential fortune.
And I guess, especially because in this case, and is so often the case, is you're talking about kids, right?
Very often, yes. I mean, again, the best example I saw of that was Jennifer Capriati, who came bursting onto the tennis scene at 13 and was burned out and ran away from her sport by the time she was 16. She did come back as an adult. She was away for several years and made a very nice comeback. But she was damaged emotionally by what she was going through, because even though athletically she was ready to compete at the top levels of the sport, as a person, she wasn't ready for what came with that. That's why I get concerned about kids turning pro as young as they did. Michelle Wee in golf is another example. Basketball players either coming straight out of high school or these days going to college for 1 year. And there are many swimmers who become stars as teenagers. Missy Franklin, who is 17 years old, is going to emerge from these Olympics as a star in swimming. Katie Ledecky, who's 15 years old, is going to the Olympics to swim in the 800 freestyle. If she were to win a gold medal, she would become a big star at the age of 15. Susan Carroll, fictional, is a 15-year-old. But the things she goes through, the things that happen to her, the decisions she faces, are all very real. I've seen it in other athletes.
Is there, in your opinion, a right way to go, or is some of it inevitable, that fame will change you regardless?
Well, some of it is inevitable. I mean, you can't stop people from writing about you or talking about you if you're or wanting to talk to you if you succeed athletically. That's the world we live in. But I do think there are ways to stay grounded. The best example I can think of in today's world is Rory McIlroy, the young golfer who won the U.S. Open last year at the age of 22. And he's from Northern Ireland. Maybe it's not a coincidence that he's not American. He's from a small town in Northern Ireland. His parents each worked two jobs when he was a kid, so Rory would have a chance to play golf. And I was having a conversation with his dad at one point last summer, and I complimented him. I said I was amazed at Rory's maturity and how he had dealt with all the fame and the fortune. And he looked at me and said, "He's a good lad, but if he gets out of line, you tell me." And we need more parents like Jerry McIlroy in sports who look at their children not as human ATM machines who are making them wealthy, but as their children who are still learning and still trying to grow up and who at times do get out of line and need to be told that they're out of line when they do get to do that.
You know, there was recently a story of Michael Phelps, who makes an appearance in this book. Michael Phelps was some trash talk against him by an Olympic teammate who said that he was upset that he didn't feel that that Michael Phelps was giving it his all and that he was wasting some of his talent. And here's a guy who is at the top and perhaps is the greatest ever in the sport of swimming. And I don't know, does he have a point?
Well, I would take the word perhaps out of that, first of all, Joe. Michael Phelps is the greatest swimmer of all time.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no debate in that. What Ryan Lochte is talking about, it's one of the hard things that swimmers have to deal with. The ultimate event in the sport is always going to be the Olympics. And there are meets in between. There are world championships, and there are other meets during the four-year interim between Olympic Games. For someone like Michael Phelps, who has won 14 gold medals in the Olympics, who won countless world championships, who's held every world record he ever wanted to hold, it's very difficult to stay inspired during that gap at this point in his life. He's been swimming since he was a little kid. He's 27 years old now. This is going to be his last swim meet, London. And I think it's been very difficult for him to maintain the intensity it takes to put in those hours, to get up at 5 in the morning. Again, this is something, as I said, I went through as a swimmer. I understand it. Again, I can't swim like Michael Phelps. The only thing we have in common is we both have two arms and two legs. But I do understand what Michael Phelps feels in terms of burnout. And he's trying to just get his act together for one last meet. And my guess, honestly, Joe, is he'll do it because he's that good.
And then you look at somebody like in Lockheed's position, you say, all right, but you just do your thing, right?
Well, yeah. And, you know, Ryan Lochte is unfortunate because he is one of the greatest swimmers of all time, too. But he's living at the same time as Michael Phelps. And so as long as Michael Phelps is around, it's going to be very difficult for Ryan Lochte to be the dominant figure in his sport. He's won gold medals in the Olympics. He's been very good. He's broken world records. But there's always Phelps out there just a little bit ahead of him. And one of the things I talk about in Rush for the Gold, because it's true, is the difference financially between gold and silver. If winning a gold is worth 100 points on a scale of 0 to 100, a silver should be worth about 50. But in the eyes of the agents and the shoe companies and all these people who want to market these athletes, a silver is worth closer to zero.
Mm.
So it's either gold or bust. And that's one of the reasons for the double entendre in the title for these athletes in terms of their future marketing.
It seems as though, and I find this fascinating in the book too, because we all see the Olympic image and the great pomp and circumstance and the beauty of it and the incredible competition, but there does, and you bring out this wonderfully in the book, but there is a little bit of a skeeviness to it, isn't there?
Just look at the International Olympic Committee. I mean,
yeah.
They constantly have bribery scandals, and they're taking payoffs, and you wouldn't catch a member of the IOC in a coach seat on an airplane any time in the next million years. It's very much about the money, you know. Jerry Maguire, show me the money. But Juan Antonio Samaranch, who did a lot of things wrong as the chairman of the IOC, had a great line years ago during, I can't even remember which scandal had popped up. I think it was a drug scandal, which, as you know, has frequently been an issue with the Olympics. It may even have been Ben Johnson in Seoul. And he said, only the athletes save the Olympics. And that's really true. Everything around the athlete is potentially corrupt. But the athletes themselves, when they get in the arena and they're allowed to perform and they're allowed to do what they've been doing all their lives and training for all their lives, they save the Olympics. They bring us to the Olympics. You know, when they walk in the opening ceremonies behind their flags, I just think that's a wonderful moment. When they're competing and doing the things they do that are so extraordinary, I think that's wonderful. And I don't know about you, Joe, but to this day, when I see an Olympian on the medal podium, I don't care if he or she is an American or not, and they play their anthem and you see them get choked up or you see them put their hands on their heart, I just don't think there's anything quite like it in sports.
No, it's an amazing moment. This is really a fun book and just fascinating and an awful lot of fun. It's Mystery at the Olympics. Rush for the Gold is the title. It is published by Knopf. John Feinstein, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Best of luck.
Joe, thanks for having me again. I appreciate it as always.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Rush for Gold, Mystery at the Olympics. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.